Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Ann Law Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lowther, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Ann Law Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther. And today, as every single episode we've ever had, I don't know that we've ever had a bad guest, but we've got another great guest. Of course, I'm talking about Bob Peters. And Bob's been on before, and you know he's at the Heritage Foundation, and he's been doing great work working on the future of the nation's nuclear arsenal, modernization, sort of all those topics. And Bob, welcome. Of course, welcome to NucleCast. It's good to see you again. Now, you and Admiral Richard wrote a great piece recently for NIP, the National Institute of Public Policy, you know, Keith Payne's outfit. And you wrote this nice article talking about escalation. And of course, I thought, you know, it's a topic we really don't talk about much on NucleCast. So I thought, let's have Bob and let's talk about escalation. So tell everybody the article, the title of the article, so they can, of course, go find it and read it, and then sort of give us a synopsis of your argument.
Yeah, thanks. So the piece is by, as you noted, Admiral Charles Richard, who's the former STRATCOM commander. And it's called On Escalation, A Tool to Be Considered, Not Dismissed. You can find it in NIP, as you said. Also, Real Clear Defense carries it, and Heritage Foundation will be publishing a link to it as well off our website. So the premise of the piece is that our national security professionals, both civilian policymakers and uniform military, have gotten to this place where they see escalation as being something that is inherently bad. They see escalation that is, it's almost a synonym in their mind for a course of action that is undesirable or a course of action that should be dismissed. And as for us, you know, maybe there are times at which you should dismiss it because it's not the right tool for the right crisis in which you find yourself. But there are times in which you may actually need to escalate. And so for us, it comes down to if you really are thinking about escalation, and you kind of take Keith Payne's definition of deterrence as the threat of withheld escalation, that is deterrence, in particular deterrence by punishment, is the unstated threat of escalation if the adversary pursues a certain course of action. Then if you say, well, we're not going to escalate, then that actually makes things less stable and it undercuts your deterrent posture. And what we say in this article is that if an adversary chooses to pursue war, they are by and large revisionist states, right? And so they pursue war because the current situation in which they find themselves is intolerable for them. And that's why they pursue us. That's why they pursue conflict. They're revisionist states. We in the United States, since the end of the Cold War, we've been a status quo state. That is, we're by and large kind of happy with the status quo. We don't want to change things radically, and so we just want to get back to the status quo ante, right? The way things were before the war began. And that makes us, in many ways, as national security professionals, risk averse, because we like what we've got. We don't want to lose it. So we're unwilling undertake behaviors that could lead us to a place where we lose what we have. Now, if you're a revisionist state and you're willing to start a war, you don't mind really engaging in risky behavior because you already hate the situation in which you find yourself. And so you're willing to escalate. But if we are unwilling to escalate as the status quo power, and the adversary knows that, they've probably baked in our response. They've probably already said, we're going to do X, and we think the United States or the U.S. allies are going to do Y. and it's going to be non-escalatory. It's going to try to bring things back down. And we know generally within what a range is that they're going to do in response to what we do. So therefore, we're okay with that. We've kind of baked that into to our calculus. And we think the rewards outweigh the consequences of what we're going to do. Unless the United States does something different, radically different, and tries to wrong foot the adversary and to make the adversary say, oh, my God, we weren't expecting that. The United States, the Americans did something that we weren't prepared for. We need to go back and rethink our plan because this could actually turn out really worse for us and things could get even worse for us than before the war started. And so, you know, what we lay on the paper, and I'm happy to talk more about it, is that fundamentally our national security professionals need to think about escalation as a tool that they should at times employ depending on the stakes, depending on the nature of the conflict in which they find themselves, and depending on, you know, how bad things are and what American interests are at that moment. So that's the general gist of the paper itself.
So if I could sort of offer what might be a, you know, a real example, it's, for example, you know, I think the Russians probably think that in a Europe scenario, maybe a Ukraine or a NATO scenario, Baltic scenario, if they were to use nuclear weapons, clear escalation, that the United States would in turn use conventional forces and would not match their escalation or, you know, escalate above them. And so therefore they think that they could, you know, dominate that escalation ladder and ultimately achieve their objectives via, you know, a fiat accompli because we won't escalate. And then if I understand what you're saying correctly, you're saying that if that's what you've sort of created as the image in the minds of your adversaries, then that's a dangerous thing to do, that you need to be willing to clearly communicate to your adversaries and be willing to, of course, to escalate with them or out-escalate them as part of your effort to ultimately be victorious.
That's exactly right. And so I'll give you a real world example. We're recording this on Monday, October 7th on the drive into the office this morning. I was listening to C-SPAN. They were doing a wrap up of the Sunday morning, you know, roundtable discussions. And they were talking about October 7th. And somebody said, you know, Israel has to do what's in their best interests in the defense of Israel. And so what's happening in the Middle East is unfortunate, but let's be honest, it's probably in Israel's best interest. And one of the panelists responded with, no, that's not right. Real leadership is about getting to a place where there is no war. That's real leadership. And I kind of, my jaw dropped open because for me, a national leader's job is to pursue the national interest of that nation. And maybe sometimes that does mean getting the war to end, but other times it means you need to prosecute a war and win that war. You know, Franklin Roosevelt, after Pearl Harbor, he exhibited leadership because he said, by God, we're going to win World War II, not we need to figure out, you know, how to de-escalate things, how to get to a world without war. It was, no, we're in it to win it. And I think far too often, American national security practitioners are far too reflexive to say, we need to de-escalate, we need to calm down, we need to get back to the negotiating table, we need to give diplomacy a chance, we need to give breathing space for dialogue. And it's not to denigrate any of those things, but to be dismissive of escalation as a viable tool that can at times be useful, I would offer is, it's kind of like cutting yourself off at the knees.
Yeah, it seems, you know, it's funny that we're sitting here talking about this because it sort of seems that we are, you know, a victim of our own success in the sense that, you know, you and I both have kids who are about the same age. And we worry that because our kids have fundamentally grown up in a world where they never want for anything. There's no hardship. There's no difficulty. There's just, will I get the new Xbox and the new iPhone I want this Christmas? Or will I have to suffer with just the new Xbox or just the new iPhone? And that's sort of their big life challenges that, you know, that's sort of modern America. So this idea that, hey, you know, we've achieved this sort of pinnacle of success and prosperity, and that we're not going to have to fight for anything anymore. And that, you know, we'll just sort of ride this, you know, into eternity. It's sort of ahistorical. And, you know, for a good historian of, you know, previous great empires, they all collapse at some point. You know, there's a great book. I think it's called The Fourth Turning, something like that. And it basically says things last for seven generations, and then eventually there's calamity, and then you have to sort of start over. And that we're sort of at that point. And this view of escalation that, hey, we just got to always look for off ramps. We got to always look for peace is, I think it's endemic of this attitude that, you know, we want things to stay exactly as they are, and we don't want anything to change. And we're going to focus on making sure every kid has a new Xbox and iPhone, and that, you know, the world's just going to stay great and wonderful. And there's sort of no willingness to sort of fight for, you know, American prosperity. Am I reading that wrong, or do you see it differently?
Look, you know, as a father, like, I do wonder, I think any parent does, in which if you work hard and you apply the gifts and the talents that God's given you, and you are able to be a provider for your family, and then you see your kids grow up in a world in which they themselves personally don't know want or hardship. And, you know, that's not to say that, you know, they don't have hard times or bad days, as everyone does, right? But you know, they go on some pretty cool family vacations, and they've got a mom and dad there that love them and give them hugs every night before bed. And they've got food in the refrigerator, and they've got warm clothes and a place to sleep that's dry and warm. You know, if they don't know true struggle and true hardship, does that undercut their ability to make hard decisions and hard choices when they become adults? I don't know. I mean, that's
it. I guess my, to sort of to draw it back to the, you know, our topic, it seems, I guess maybe I didn't make my, wasn't all that clear, but it seems that, you know, escalation is part of this willingness to fight.
Yeah.
And because of our prosperity, we seem to be more reticent to actually fight, because it's disruptive to our lifestyle. It's disruptive to our sort of comfort. I guess maybe that's the point I'm trying to make. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. I think there may be something there. And like I said, we're a status quo power, right? And so the United States is a status quo power. And so we do not want to see things change. We don't want to see, you know, and like I said earlier, because we're happy with what we have, we don't want to risk losing what we have. And escalation inherently involves risk. It is,
yeah,
take the risk out of escalation. And I do think that there is a link there between being a status quo power, therefore you are risk averse, therefore you do not want, or you're very hesitant to pursue escalation because of the potential downsides. But ultimately, I think that is, I think that's self-defeating. If you wish away escalation without actually understanding that, without actually understanding the benefits of escalation, or understanding the real downsides of if you pursue a national security policy that ground rules out escalation from the get-go. And in that sense, I do think it has real implications for strategic stability. The bad guys, I think, almost become incentivized to engage in conflict, or at least go up to the brink of conflict, because they kind of know what the status quo power is going to do, and what they are and are not willing to risk. And if you're more willing to let the dice fly high, you know, to paraphrase Caesar, then I think that you have the ability to set not only the timing of violence, but the tempo and nature of the violence itself. And so,
yeah, and it seems as though over the last, you know, 20 plus years, if you think back to, you know, 9/11, and right before 9/11, Osama bin Laden said that America was a paper tiger, and that America would be unwilling to fight. And then ultimately we have the 9/11 attacks, and then, you know, the country has to prove that it isn't a paper tiger and that it is willing to fight. And it seems like we're sort of in that position again. And this time we're talking about escalation, particularly with nuclear weapons. And this is one where we sort of don't want to leave it to our adversaries to say, well, you know, America's a paper tiger. You know, we can attack them. They won't fight. We don't really want to put ourselves in that position, because it won't be, you know, the loss of the Twin Towers. It'll be, you know, perhaps a far greater loss. And so demonstrating that we are willing to escalate, I think, is probably far more important in this circumstance than even it was, you know, prior to 9/11.
Yeah, we our paper, it's not exclusively on nuclear weapons. I mean, Admiral Richard and I used two examples of real world examples that we witnessed that take place during the course of tabletop exercises or simulations. And one is a purely conventional fight, and the other is purely nuclear. In both instances, the blue players, the American military officers who were playing a notional blue, so good guys, did not escalate, and it had catastrophic impacts up by the end of the game. And so one of the examples we use is that red invades a green ally, and there's no nukes being tossed, but the blue players who are emulating a combatant command staff say, well, we don't want to flow forces from the blue homeland overseas into green, because that could be seen as escalatory by red. And we're just going to try to get things to slow down and turn the heat down on the conflict. And so the consequence is that by move three, they're getting their butts handed to them, and red has marched halfway across green. And there's no way for blue to stave off the fall of green capital without using nuclear weapons. And so at the end of the game, you know, when asked what they would have done differently, an 06, a colonel responded with, boy, I sure wish we had flowed forces into theater and move one.
Yeah.
But they didn't, because they're afraid of escalation. The other example was a group of senior military officers. So they're all general officers or flag officers, and they're playing a notional advisory team for the president, in which a non-treaty ally, green, was invaded by red, and red used a limited number of low yield weapons on green. And so then it was, what do we want to do? And the blue players who were advising the blue president said, well, we're going to just pursue conventional operations only. And red really paid no consequence for any nuclear employment. And so what happened was, by the end of the game, there were 41 additional nuclear detonations later, 41, that took place not only across non-treaty ally green, but across a number of actual treaty ally greens. Like, no kidding, they had a blue security guarantee. And at the end of the game, the player said, well, I guess we have to have a nuclear response now to get red to stop using these nukes. But it should come from our other nuclear-armed allies within the theater. It shouldn't come from the blue homeland, because that'll show that we're a unified alliance. So we're going to recommend that our treaty ally blues, who are also have nuclear weapons, should use their nuclear weapons in response. And it's maybe that's the right answer, maybe that's the wrong answer, who knows? But both groups were very hesitant to escalate, and they were very restrained. And, you know, both times, both examples that Admiral Richard and I used, blue got their butts handed to them. And so I think that this hesitancy, with all the caveats that go with, it's a simulation, it's a tabletop, you don't draw too much. But we've seen this time and time again, in which a hesitancy to escalate and accept risk, operational risk, creates real, real strategic challenges for blue.
Well, it's that time of the show where we have to take a quick break, so we're going to do that. But when we come back, you know, we've talked about the problem. So we've sort of identified this escalation problem and the unwillingness to be able to do it or be willing to. I want to talk about why we're unwilling when we come back. So you're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back. This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the Ann Law Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence. And we're back. We're talking to Bob Peters about his great article on escalation. So we've clearly identified the problem. So what if you were to try to, you know, explain why this is such a challenge for us, for the Americans, for whether it be civilian or military, because and I'll be honest with you, I'm a little surprised. You know, I've seen some of the same challenges in you know, the Title X war games I play, but you know, I started playing these probably close to 20 years ago whenever we thought, you know, nuclear war was unlikely. But as we've sort of come into the, you know, the three body problem and, you know, our modern age, this is something you got to think about far more seriously with, you know, prospects and probabilities that are not the same as they were 15 years ago. And we've been at this a while now. So I'm surprised to hear that even today, the problem we had 15 years ago is still the problem of today, that this unwillingness to use nukes. Why do you think that this is the way our side thinks about this?
So I think there's two reasons, one of which we explore in the paper that I've already touched upon, so we won't delve into that. I think it's the nature of officers coming of age in which they're the status quo power, so they're unwilling to accept risk.
Yeah.
So there's that, and that's in the paper. I won't you know, continue to beat that. But the other thing, I'll just from my own personal view, is that I think part of it is the problem of JPME, Joint Professional Military Education. Over the last 20 years, there's been a real emphasis on what's called the dime. And the dime is a construct that's taught in JPME. So this is your war colleges and so forth, that if you're an officer, kind of a mid-grade officer, you get sent off to get your master's degree. And it's become very fashionable over the last two decades to talk about diplomacy for the D, information for the I, military for the M, and then economics, the E. And you put those together and that becomes the dime. And I think that military officers have this beaten them this into their skull, that they need to think about the dime. And I'm not trying to belittle at all the importance of diplomacy and information economics. It's important, particularly if you're a combatant commander, if you're a four-star. You have to understand how the military component of national power fits into the broader aspects of the tools that a superpower can bring. Comma, however, for most of those cats who are never going to be combatant commanders, they should be thinking about the military component. And, you know, what can I do with the forces assigned to me? What could I do if I had additional forces assigned to me? What can I do with my forces to help out the other guy achieve his military objectives and so forth? They should be focusing on the military aspect of the problem. And far too often, what I've observed is some you know, wannabe super brain genius that's got oat clusters or an eagle on his or her shoulders says, well, we need to understand that, you know, there's more to the dime than just the M. They should be thinking about diplomacy and information and economics. And then they start thinking about like diplomatic engagements and off ramps, which I'll touch upon in a moment. And for me, it's like, brother, that ain't your job. Like, you're the dude in a military uniform, or you're the dudette in a military uniform. I want you to think about using military force to achieve the objectives that have been laid out for you by higher command. And you're never going to be as good at, diplomacy or economics than somebody in Foggy Bottom or the Department of Treasury. You're not. So don't even try. I want you to be focused like a laser on employing military power. And kind of the other part of this is in JPME and elsewhere, I think there's a big focus on off-ramps. And the off-ramp is the idea of, well, we need to give the adversary a graceful exit. We need to give the adversary a way out of this path that they're on. And the thing, and oftentimes you see this in simulations or war games in which blue is getting their brains beaten out by red, the bad guys. And it's not apparent that there's an easy military solution at hand. For whatever reason, the nature of the simulation, blue's taking it on the chin. And there always will be somebody that says, well, we need to give them an off-ramp. And people will nod their head wisely and tug at their chin. And they don't understand that if you're losing, you're in no position to offer an off-ramp.
Yeah.
And the analogy that Admiral Richard and I use in our paper is two middle school boys are fighting after class one day. The boy who's winning is in a position to offer an off-ramp to the boy who's losing. The kid who's getting, you know, beaten up has only got four options. He can agree to the terms of the boy who's winning the fight. You know, he can give him his lunch money. He can give him his backpack, whatever. Give him his bike, whatever. Two, he can try to break free and run home, right? Go back home and lock the door. Three, he can hope for outside third-party intervention or more allies to come save his bacon. Or lastly, he can come up with a bold new strategy to get victory out of this losing hand that he's been playing, right? But he ain't in any position to say, hey, look, I think I know a way for you to get out of this situation that you find yourself in, as the kid's sitting on his chest, you know, beating his
pounded him, yeah.
Right. You know, that was never going to work. But somehow we've got military officers that think, as they're getting, again, their butts handed to them in a war game by Red, well, we just need to offer Red an off-ramp, and then this war will end. Red's happy. He didn't like the status quo, which is why he initiated the conflict to begin with. He wants a new status quo. And so far,
he's achieving it.
Right.
Yeah.
He's winning. So why would he accept your off-ramp?
To return to the status quo, by the way.
Right. He ain't never going to accept the status quo ante if he's winning the war that he initiated. He wants you to accept the new status quo that he's offering. Or, failing that, he's happy for you to go back home and stay out of his business.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm with you. I mean, if you go back to the end of World War II and you look at the Japanese before they, you know, we wanted unconditional surrender, and they said, well, we really don't want to do that. So if we drag this war on long enough and we kill enough Americans, maybe the Americans will give us the kind of a surrender we want. So, and we're saying that, you know, these actual lessons that we should have learned, you know, those aren't the ones to learn. We'll create new ones that these basic rules don't apply. Okay. So it's that time of the show before we run out. Bob the Genie comes out, no relation, by the way. And, you get three wishes. Bob Peters, unrelated to Bob the Genie, what is your first wish?
That we would de-emphasize JPME, de-emphasize the dime within JPME. That's thing one. And that's not to say that's never taught, but like in JPME, they need to have a heart-to-heart with our military officers and our civilians to say, understand that the M is a broader portion of the dime, and these other things exist, but you guys and you gals are going to be focusing on the M. That's thing one, is I think there needs to be some recalibration, a swing in the pendulum within JPME. Thing two is, you know, I think we need to spend some more time actually thinking about what it means to be a status quo power versus a revisionist power at the highest echelons.
And, yeah, for sure.
And then that needs to trickle its way back down through the ranks to the mid-grade officers, because we've got to get out of this reflexive hesitancy to even conceptualize escalation. And we say in the paper that it even goes higher than combatant command 4-star level. You see this with, you know, Secretary of Defense and Secretary Blinken, in which they say, well, things in the Middle East need to de-escalate, or any strike on Iran would be escalatory. Well, maybe they would be escalatory, but that's not making the case for why that would be a bad thing. Make the case on its own merits as to why. I'm making something up. Israel striking the Iranian nuclear program would be a bad thing. Make that case on its merits.
Yeah.
Saying, well, striking the Iranian nuclear facilities would be escalatory, as though that's the end of the conversation. We need to change how we talk about escalation, because the way we even talk about it within the broader national dialogue is in a negative light. And again, it's a tool, like it's a hammer, right? Like a hammer can be great for like building a new garage, or you can, you know, bash someone's brains out. You just have to think about it as a tool. The third and final wish would be I really want to see more wargaming amongst the officers who are going to be going up, because they need to understand how we actually need to think about the employment of force at the operational to strategic level. We're terrific at the tactical level, but I would submit that our hesitancy to accept operational risk can have strategic consequences for us as a nation and downsize and maybe even end up losing the war. So I think that there's a bit of a dichotomy there in that hesitancy to accept operational risk means that we very often take on more strategic risk within the war and then again with at the national level. And I think this is kind of an underexplored area, but the more I kind of look at this, I think it's kind of a meta lesson for me is hesitancy and fear of risk can have real downsides, and we're accepting risk in the wrong places. Like, as an example, when it comes to plutonium pit production, and I know this is very orthogonal to what we're talking about, but like, we have incredibly rigorous standards when it comes to environmental safety and health safety and workplace safety when it comes to producing plutonium pits. And I'm not advocating that we should just be like willy-nilly, like dumping, you know, plutonium in the Savannah River. I'm not saying that. But we're accepting no tactical or operational risk. And so we're only just barely producing any plutonium pits. And the consequence of that is we're accepting enormous strategic risk because the modernization program is so damn slow. And I use plutonium pits as an example, but you can see this across the board, whether it's the building of Sentinel or Columbia. We're so risk adverse when it comes to industrial policy that we're accepting huge amounts of strategic risk at the high end. And so I do think that there's kind of like a meta analysis that needs to be done that says, why do states accept strategic risk to buy down operational and tactical risk? And I just think that's a really underexplored topic.
No, I agree with that. I'm completely in agreement, you know, and it seems like this concept of escalation, and it's almost reminds me of that scene, you know, in what is it? Return of the Jedi, maybe, where they're going, where Luke and Obi-Wan they have C-3PO and R2-D2, and the stormtrooper comes up and, you know, Obi-Wan says, these are not the droids you're looking for. And we just sort of do a hand wave and say, this is escalatory and that's bad. And it's just like, this is destabilizing and therefore bad. And yeah. I've never even seen a definition of stability. I don't know what it actually means. I just know that anything that is sort of supportive of nuclear is destabilizing. Anything that America wants to do is destabilizing. And so therefore can't do anything that's good for America. It's always destabilizing.
Missile defense is very destabilizing. Why?
Yeah.
There's never a rational explanation for why missile defense is destabilizing.
Yeah. That's the challenge with, you know, when you don't have large, you know, sort of a statistical large N on which you can measure something, because we haven't fought nuclear wars, then it allows people to sort of make these generalizations that have no support, which is, you know, part of our bigger challenge. But
so one correction, Adam,
sure.
That scene is not Return of the Jedi. That scene is from the end of the first act of the original Star Wars movie.
Okay. All right.
They were on the planet of Tatooine.
Tatooine. Right. There we go.
Obi-Wan Kenobi did the Jedi mind trick on the stormtroopers. That is his second greatest events from the original trilogy of Star Wars. The first greatest, of course, is when he's on the planet Dagobah in Return of the Jedi, in which he's a ghost. And ghost Obi-Wan, if you recall, has to sit down and take a break on a tree log next to Luke because the ghost gets tired, which is the greatest Obi-Wan scene in the original Star Wars trilogy is ghost Obi-Wan needs a break and has to take a seat.
All right. Well, there you have it, folks. Unfortunately, we're out of time, so we'll end with a tired Obi-Wan sitting on a log as a ghost. Of course, Bob Peters, thanks for joining us. It was great talking. It's a great topic. I mean, you guys chose a great you know, a great topic to talk about to highlight what is clearly an absurd perspective, but one that I would say is probably the dominant perspective.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely. It is.
All right. So thanks, Bob, of course. And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of NucleCast. And we'll see you next time. Well, great discussion about escalation. You know, it's a hard topic. It's one that you don't have like lots of data that you can just analyze the data and come up with a crisp and clear answer. It's, you know, one you sort of have to think through logically. And that's, of course, what makes it challenging. And for those that sort of dismiss the logic of it, and it's an emotional argument. And it's hard to argue emotion with logic. So I enjoyed the discussion with Bob. Hopefully you enjoyed it as well.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.